everybody. Thank you so much to Roz and Abner Goldstein, Rabbi Wolpe, for that beautiful introduction. Thank you so much. I am deeply honored to be here in the presence not just of Sally, but of my beautiful sister, Aura, and my brother-in-law, Fred. So many friends who've come here, Rabbi Boskila, Mori Urabi. I'm deeply delighted and upset that now I have to depress you. I'm here to talk about existential threats. Existential threats, the threat to the very existence of a nation. Now, the good news is that existential threats are very rare in human history. And I'm speaking as an historian now, very rare for a nation to face a threat to its continued existence. A couple of examples from recent history. World War II, when the Allies went to war against Nazi Germany and Japan, their goal was not to destroy the state of Germany or the state of Japan. It was to topple their heinous governments, but not to eliminate the German people, not to eliminate the Japanese people. The United States, to the best of my knowledge, has never faced a true existential threat. If you had lost the Revolutionary War against the British, what is the worst thing that would have happened to you? You would have remained 13 colonies for a little while longer under the British. Maybe today you'd be part of the British Commonwealth, but the American people would not have been destroyed. Even if the South had prevailed over the North in the Civil War, would the United States, would the American people have ceased to exist? Did anybody think, even in World War II, that Japanese tanks would be parading down Wiltshire Boulevard or New York and the Fifth Avenue? Extremely doubtful whether America faced an existential threat at any time in its national existence. It is very rare. And when existential threats do confront a state, it is the source of profound upheavals, civil wars, revolutions, governments toppling, existential threats. Now the bad news. The state of Israel faces not one, not two, but multiple existential threats every single day. Israelis wake up and face many existential threats. We face a burgeoning existential threat from an Iran that is rapidly nuclearizing. An Iran is rapidly nuclearizing under a government that swears every day, and it swears so often that it's not even reported in the press in this country anymore. It swears to wipe the Jewish state off the map. Now, Iran with a nuclear weapon threatens Israel's existence on multiple levels, not just on the obvious level of some crazy mullah in Tehran pressing a button and eliminating the Jewish state, because we are a one-bomb country. The fact that Israel may or may not have a second strike capability is absolutely irrelevant to the rest of us, because we won't be around to see it happen. We're a one-bomb country. But that's just the beginning of the existential threat. Iran, with a bomb, with nuclear capabilities, will be able to pass on those capabilities to third-party elements in the Middle East, to terrorist organizations. And Israel cannot seal its borders hermetically. And that technology, in the form, say, of a dirty bomb, could be smuggled into our borders and could eliminate the Jewish state in an instant. Iran, with a bomb, will reduce Israel's ability to strike back at terrorists almost to zero. Take, for example, Hezbollah fires a Katyusha rocket into northern Israel. Israel wants to respond to the Katyusha rocket, but the minute we move to do so, Iran goes on nuclear alert. And guess what happens? The tourists stop coming. The foreign investment goes away. And we die economically. Iran kills us without ever firing a single shot. We can't even respond to a Katyusha rocket. And if that's not the end of the existential threats posed by Iran by its nuclear capabilities, once Iran gets the bomb, then no less than 13 of our neighbors have gone on record saying they're going to get a bomb too. So we'll be facing a nuclear Jordan, a nuclear Saudi Arabia, a nuclear Egypt, a nuclear Yemen. We'll be living in a nuclear neighborhood which is totally unstable, and life in Israel will become untenable. We face an existential threat from a nuclear Iran. We face an existential threat from terror. There was a time, now many years ago, when Israel viewed terror as more or less a nuisance. Terrorists would hijack a plane, occasionally they'd attack a bus, put a bomb somewhere. It was a nuisance. We could exist with terror. It was terrible, but we could coexist with it. And then the year 2000 came about. Year 2000, the Palestinians launched their terror war with their multiple terrorist suicide bombings every single day. And the tourism went away. The foreign investment went away. We couldn't leave our houses. We couldn't even go out to a restaurant. They were killing our country. We learned that terrorism also poses an existential threat to the Jewish state. And then the rockets began to fall, the Qassam rockets from Gaza and the Katyushas from southern Lebanon. And we learned that terrorists are capable of transforming large swaths of the state of Israel in the north and around the Gaza Strip into uninhabitable territories. And if those rockets ever found their way into the West Bank, and all of our major population and industrial areas came within range of those missiles, then life within Israel would cease to exist. People would simply leave. So terror also poses an existential threat to the state of Israel. It is no mere nuisance. Israel faces a demographic threat. And this is probably the thorniest existential threat we face in form of our demography. Israel is a Jewish state. Our existence as a Jewish state is predicated on maintaining a stable Jewish majority of at least 70%. Now, Israel, within its pre-67 borders, has a large Arab minority. About one-fifth of the population of the state of Israel is Arab, is non-Jewish. But if you add to that the area beyond the 67 border, now in the West Bank, you will have a situation of a Palestinian Arab population, which is multiplying very, very fast. And though there are different statistics and different estimates about their rate of increase, the fact of the matter is within 10, 15, at the utmost 20 years from now, you will have parity between the absolute number of Jews and Arabs between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, and Israel as a Jewish state will cease to exist. It is an existential threat. Now, the obvious solution to this would be a two-state arrangement of a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, and they have their state, we have our state. But alas, I'm not particularly sanguine about the chances for creating a two-state solution. There are problems on the Israeli side. I participated in 2005 in the evacuation of 21 settlements, 8,100 settlers from the Gaza Strip. And those of you who are around on Sunday, I'll be talking in greater detail about my experiences in Gaza in 2005. But what I'll tell you tonight is that the Israeli evacuation from Gaza was the largest single Israeli army operation since the 1973 Yom Kippur War. 55,000 Israeli soldiers had to be called up to remove these 8,100 settlers. And that was in the Gaza Strip. And even among many religious Jews in Israel, there is a debate about whether Gaza actually constitutes part of the God-given land of Israel. On the West Bank, there are at least 250,000 settlers, and there is no debate about whether the West Bank, which includes our holy cities of Hebron and East Jerusalem, as well as the biblical cities of Jericho and Bethel, whether the West Bank constitutes part of the land of Israel. The West Bank is the land of Israel par excellence. And creating a Palestinian state on the West Bank will require removing, at the very least, 80,000 Jews from their homes and as many as 150,000 Jews from their homes. Now, I personally do not see an Israeli government, either the current government, a future government, that is capable of willing or doing such a thing. And that is the problem on the Israeli side. On the Palestinian sides, the problems are manifold. First of all, the Palestinians don't even control all their territories. Palestinians are now divided between the al-Fatah-controlled Palestinian Authority on the West Bank, Hamas in Gaza, so there's no unified Palestinian leadership with whom we can negotiate. The Palestinians have never, even in al-Fatah, have never expressed a willingness to accept Israel as a Jewish state. Matter of fact, their leaders say expressly that they will never accept Israel as a Jewish state. And there is certainly no Palestinian leader in al-Fatah or any other faction who's willing to sign off on the demand for the return of between 6 and 8 million Palestinian refugees to pre-67 Israel, an act that, if it is carried out, will transform Israel from a de jure Jewish state into a de facto Palestinian state. Moreover, as an historian, I'll tell you, looking back 80 years, the Palestinians have never succeeded in sustaining even a minor sovereign structure. I don't know who thinks that they can sustain a full state. So I'm not at all confident about the ability of anybody to negotiate a two-state solution. And in light of that, of the fact that Israel faces this demographic threat, Israel faces an existential threat from a growing Palestinian population within the territories under its control. Israel faces an ecological threat. You've been there, you've been to Israel. It's hot, it's dry. Have you noticed that? We do not have water. We have less and less water every year. Our water needs grow by 4% every single year. Israel, at one point, we thought someday we'd reach 2 million population. The population of the State of Israel has now exceeded 7 million. And we've had four rotten years of very, very little rainfall. Our major water sources are the Sea of Galilee and our underground aquifer. The Sea of Galilee is now 5 meters below the red line. That is the line it is not supposed to go ever in terms of its waters. Our aquifers have emptied out, and they're filling up with salt water. So not only do we have less water every year, our quality of water goes down. Israel faces an ecological, existential threat. Have I ruined your night? Are you completely despondent? Hold on. We are dealing with every single one of these existential threats, sometimes with better success than other times, but the state of Israel is grappling with each and every one of these challenges. Water. Now, the crazy thing about this Jewish state, very inventive, you know, we're inventing all sorts of things. Israel leads the world in desalinization technology. Do you know that? We are far ahead of everybody, and the great thing about the state of Israel, we've been making desalinization plants for years for export. Finally, we are turning around and making them from ourselves. Within 2 years, we will have the world's largest desalinization plant up and running in Ashkelon. Even now, Israel leads the world in the percentage of water that is reclaimed from sewage and reclaimed from the sea. 16% of our water supply is reclaimed from sewage. Think about that next time you're in a hotel in Jerusalem and you want to take a glass of tap water. You may have a sense of deja vu there. We will be parched for the next couple of years, but we will not die of thirst. We will not succumb to an ecological, existential threat. The demographic threat, again, very thorny. Very thorny, but there is a growing realization on the part of all Israeli leaders, left, right, center, that we cannot survive as a Jewish state and maintain absolute control over all the Palestinian population on the West Bank. And whether it involves moving for an attempted two-state solution, I don't think it's going to happen, or what is more likely, another unilateral act that will withdraw our border to the east to maintain the maximum number of Arabs to the east of that border and the maximum number of Jews to the west of that border, also, I would hope, the maximum amount of Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, to the west of that border. Future Israeli governments will take that step. I'm very confident of it. Terror, just when we thought we were going to die, and we really thought we were going to die in 2000, 2002, the Israeli army came back. And we did what no army in history has ever done. A regular conventional force overcame terror for the first time. And even Israeli generals in 2000, 2001 said it couldn't be done, and it could be done. Israel invented new means of countering terror. We invented new tactics of coordinating aerial observance with ground operations, coordinating commando units with intelligence sources. We prevailed over terror. We built a separation barrier, which is severely cut back into the terrorists' ability to conduct suicide operations against us. Suicide operations can never fully be eliminated. We're always going to have to live with that danger. And though it's not reported here, the Israeli press reports almost every day Palestinians trying to smuggle bombs into our country, almost every single day. But our lives are relatively terror-free today, thanks to the inventiveness and courage of the Israel Defense Forces. And I'll be talking more about that on Sunday, some of our personal experiences of myself and of my family in the battle against terror. Come to hear that one. The rockets. Rockets are an extreme problem for us. The Palestinians are firing at us rockets from mid-20th century. They're basically World War II era rockets, whether they're Qassam rockets or Katyusha rockets being fired by Hezbollah in Lebanon. We have not found a solution for that, but we are working on three different systems. The most advanced of these, the Dome system, based on laser technology, will be up and running by 2010. And we will have a solution for the rockets. We will not succumb to terror. I promise you, we will not succumb to terror. Iran. Iran. Now, I'm not privy to any classified information about this. But I will assure you with fullness, without any reservations, unequivocally, that Israel will not allow Iran to acquire nuclear weaponry. How we will do it? It's difficult. Israel, you may notice, does not have strategic bombers. Only the United States does. Israel cannot eliminate Iran's nuclear program. We cannot. We can, however, make several central facilities in that program either uninhabitable or inaccessible. Read into that what you will. And there are more than one way to take out a nuclear program, not just by aircraft from the sky. There are parts that can go boom in the night. There are technicians and scientists working on that program who could meet rather unfortunate accidents, and it has happened. We've managed to delay this program significantly already, and we're not the only people operating against the Iranians. We're not. The United States, other European countries are operating against the Iranians as well. We will not allow Iran to possess this weapon. We simply will not. And so Israel, on every level, to various degrees of success, sometimes with complete success, is grappling with these existential threats. And yet, the greatest existential threat is not from the Iranians, it's not from terror, it's not demography, it's not ecological. The greatest existential threat we face is from ourselves. It is from the erosion of the Zionist ethos in the state of Israel, Israel's transformation from a largely socialist, collectivist, volunteerist society into a capitalist, me-generation society, the growth of corruption in Israel's leadership circles. This is the true existential threat. And why is this existential threat worse than even the Iranian existential threat? Because this is the existential threat that undermines our ability to deal with all the other ones. And what are we doing about that? Well, on the level of corruption, there is good news. Israel has caught a hold of itself after sinking, I must tell you, quite low. In the last 2 years, we have seen the resignation of a treasury minister. We've seen a stepping down of a prime minister on corruption charges, something that was unthinkable before. And now all three major parties, as they prepare for the elections in February, are running on anti-corruption platforms. The coup has gone off and gotten a hold of Benny Begin and Dan Meridor, these incorruptible Israeli politicians. The left has got a hold of Amos Oz and Aleph Bet Yehoshua, wonderful writers. Corruption has become a major issue in the state of Israel, and it is very good news. Very good. We are purging ourselves of this. There are grassroots movements afoot to reform Israel's political system, because much of that corruption in the coalition system is hardwired. It's hard-baked into the system, and that has to change as well. As for collectivism, as for volunteerism, my personal opinion is that it's the erosion is grossly exaggerated. Whether it be the grassroots young Jerusalemite party that was started in our living room last year to eliminate corruption in Jerusalem, to bring back young people and jobs to Jerusalem. Two of the young people who met in our living room just last year just won seats on the Jerusalem municipality. We have a lot of nachas from that. But a personal experience. 2006 was the Lebanon War, and it was the first general call-up of the IDF reserves since the 1982 first Lebanon War. And I took part in the 1982 Lebanon War, and I know that about 70% of Israelis responded to that call-up. In 1967, about 75% of the Israelis responded to the call-up. In 2006, over 100% of all Israeli reservists reported for duty in that war. That means they left their homes at the height of the holiday season to go off and go to war and defend their country and perhaps not come back. What country on earth? What country on earth would that happen? And would it happen in this country? It's severely doubted. And so Israel is dealing with that existential threat as well, that paramount existential threat. And I look at the way that we are dealing with this, and I say to myself, oi. Can we really do this all at once? How can we possibly do this? And then I recall my perspective as an historian. It really helps to be an historian sometimes. It really does. Because I look at Israel today, and then I remember what Israel was like in 1948. In 1948, there were 600,000 Israelis. A large percentage of the population had just arrived as Holocaust survivors. We were facing invasion from six Arab armies armed with hundreds of planes and tanks and artillery pieces, and we had handguns. We didn't have a single plane, we didn't have a single tank. We had no international allies. We certainly did not have an alliance with the United States. Surrounded by hostility, not just from the Arabs, but from the Soviet blocs, from the Indians, from the Chinese. And we won. And we survived. And not only did we survive, but we managed to create a modern economy. And we managed to absorb 10 times our original number of immigrants within a very short period. The state of Israel did this. And 19 years later, in 1967, we were again surrounded by a million Arab soldiers. And again, we had no allies. Actually, we had one ally, the French, and they switched sides the night before the war. Facing a hostile Soviet bloc, a hostile China, a hostile India, the United States would not come to our aid. There was no alliance with the United States. The economy collapsed in 1967. Remember, there was an old joke floating around. The last Israeli out of Ben Gurion, out of Lod Airport, should close the lights because everyone was fleeing. And we won. And we turned around and we defeated three major Arab armies and almost quadrupled the territorial size of our country. And I look at Israel today in 2008, and I want to say to you categorically that never before in Israel's history has Israel enjoyed such vast geostrategic economic advantages that we have today. We are in an incalculably better situation than we are at any time in our history. Think about it. Peace with Jordan and Egypt. Not the greatest peace arrangement. We haven't fought them in many, many years. We have relations with the former Soviet bloc countries. Some of our closest relations are with the former Soviet bloc countries. We have a fantastic relationship with China. Our trade with China went up 35% last year. It's supposed to go up even higher next year. China. A great relationship with India. India wouldn't even host our Davis Cup team once upon a time. Now we have joint maneuvers with the Indian Navy. I hardly even knew that India had a Navy. We have one. Sinking pirate ships this week. Greatly improved relationship with Western Europe, including with France. An historic alliance with the United States. And I assure you that America's relationship with the United States is the most firm and multifaceted alliance that the United States has with any country today, including Great Britain. Amazing. And our economy. Our economy, which is weathering this storm, which is stable, which is still has a significant growth rate. Do you know that this week the shekel is the strongest currency on the world market? 20 years ago, we were using this stuff to like light the mangal, to light the barbecue. You can't invest in shekels. They're where it's at this week. This is the Israeli economy. Isn't this extraordinary? Isn't this amazing? This, in addition to six world-class universities, where I just read a statistic this week that the Weizmann Institute was listed the number one research facility in the world in sciences. My God, a thriving youth culture, great rock music, fabulous rock music. A tourism industry which is booming. I was mentioning to Roz during dinner that the month of May was the largest month in Israel tourism history. Broke all the records in Israel. 2008, Israel. And I look at these accomplishments, and I look at the threats that we face, the challenges we face, and I still say, oy. I still don't know how it is that millions of us get up every morning and raise our kids in this country and go to work and enjoy our lives, and we enjoy our lives. Life in Israel is so rich and so full. How do we do it? And I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer as a commentator on political affairs. I don't have an answer as a historian. History cannot give you an answer for this question. I only have one answer, and that's an answer as a Jew. That the state of Israel is a Jewish state, not just because 80% of its population is Jewish, not just because our symbols are Jewish symbols or our language is the Hebrew language, because Israel is intrinsically, inherently a Jewish state, and for 3,000 years the Jewish people have been overcoming existential threats. It's one of the things that we excel at. And the reason we excel at that is the same reason you're here tonight. It is the faith of Israel. It is the resilience and morals of Israel. It is our book in Israel. This is what enables us to overcome these threats. This is what has led us to be where we are in 2008 and enabled us to survive the challenges of 48 and 67 and incomparable other existential threat challenges that we have overcome. This is what it's about. And it is my faith in that faith that enables me not just to say that Israel has survived, but that Israel has thrived. And I am fully confident, fully aware of all the threats we face, fully confident that we will continue not just to survive, but to thrive in years to come. I told you I wouldn't depress you too much. Thank you. Questions? A question right away.
Yeah, we don't want to keep our guest speaker for too long, but we are going to take a couple of questions. So go ahead. Next.
Is that book out now?
Yes.
I refuse to blurb that book. And I'm a promiscuous blurber. Yeah. Go ahead. It wasn't a question, I interrupted her. Yeah.
My question is there a concept about trying to make peace with Iran as the negotiating partner, the most powerful force in the Middle East?
Okay. All right, this book, I got this book across my desk in manuscript form last summer. It's written by a former high-ranking CIA officer with an expertise in the Persian Gulf, and Robert Baer. And I said I'm a promiscuous blurber. I blurb a lot of books. I refuse to blurb this book. I thought it was a work of, I thought it was outrageous. What he says is that basically Iran has won the war and America has lost, and that America should cut its losses by recognizing Iranian primacy in the Persian Gulf. That we should, listen to what he says, not only should America abandon Israel and allow Israel to become basically a satrapy of Iran, but America should force the Saudis to relinquish Mecca and Medina to Iran. You're laughing. This is a high-ranking CIA officer. That the United States should acknowledge the fact that Iran is going to nuclearize and allow Iran to nuclearize and simply pull out of Iraq and allow Iran to take over Iraq as well. This is a serious book, folks, published by a reputable author. And it's simply, it is the ultimate surrender. It is ultimately the surrender. And if even if Robert Baer thinks that if America would do that, you think the Iranians are going to stop there? The Iranians are on a roll. They are an extremely aggressive and irrational regime. And they will come at you. This isn't Vietnam 1975, where you can pick up and go home and be confident that the Vietnamese are not going to follow you down Wiltshire Boulevard here. The Iranians will follow you, And they'll follow you to Los Angeles, and they'll follow you to New York. And if America doesn't stand up the way I'm confident Israel is going to stand up against Iran, then there will be no end to it. And all of Robert Baer's formulae for surrender are not going to help him. That's why. That's what I felt about that book. And it's out now, huh? That's wonderful. That's great. Okay. Surrender. Oh boy.
I realize there is hope.
Mm. Yes. Yes. What you heard tonight was the cliff notes of a paper that I gave at my institute in Jerusalem several years ago. It was a closed session. The paper I gave was called Seven Existential Threats Facing Israel. One of them was the Haredi threat. And why did I say the Haredi pose an existential threat? Because they were a rapidly growing population. There's a statistic that says by the year 2012, one out of every five Israeli school children will be ultra-Orthodox Haredi. And this is a population, and while it's very difficult to generalize, in a broad sense, this is a population that doesn't recognize legitimacy of the Jewish Zionist state, doesn't respect its symbols, doesn't serve in the army with very, very few exceptions. And doesn't particularly respect its laws, and they were a huge drain on the society. Economically, and many Israelis, it was an existential threat because it was very demoralizing for Israel that this was happening, and many secular Israelis, and not just secular Israelis, traditional Israelis, will say, listen, I'm not going to support these people. I'm going to go move to Brooklyn. And therein lies the existential threat. Now, many people sitting around the table, you should know, took exception to this. They said that you're wrong. The Haredim are not an existential threat. There's an opportunity there to bring them around. I remain skeptical of that. Having said that, I see progress. I see progress, for example, in Jerusalem, in the election last week of Nir Barkat, my former commanding officer, who's going to revitalize Jerusalem. And the Haredim tried to stop him, and they couldn't. The Haredi problem will be solved through one of two ways. I would rather have it be solved by the first way, which is a reform of Israel's political system that will eliminate the process of buying off Haredi parties to join a coalition, because that perpetuates the yeshiva programs that keep these Haredis uneducated. They get second grade educations. They can't go into the workforce. They remain dependent on their rabbis. It's a whole perpetuation. Either that's going to stop, or a likelier scenario, but I think a rather unfortunate scenario, is that the entire Haredi apparatus is going to collapse. Because they are procreating at a rate that's so much faster than the amount, than the increments of government money they receive, and a larger percentage of the Haredi population falls beneath the poverty line every year, eventually the whole thing's going to collapse. It's interesting, you know, when Benjamin Netanyahu was the Treasury Minister for the Treasury, he reduced to a significant extent the subsidies that families were getting for additional children. And this hurt two populations, the Haredi population and the Arab population. The Arab population, their rate of increase plummeted to the degree that the natural rate of increase among Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews is almost identical today. I say this because many people ask me, oh, even if you give up the West Bank, you're still going to have a demographic threat. You won't. The rate of increase among the Haredim stayed exactly the same. It's impervious to economic constraints of that nature. So you've touched on a very sensitive issue, and I'm aware of it. And you should know that there are different Israeli opinions about them. I think what I said tonight, none of my colleagues would disagree with about Iran, about terror, about ecological, about demography. About the Haredim, there's some disagreement.
Last question. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. You're talking about the Israeli universities, and yeah, I've read a lot about the brain drain.
Yep.
The Israelis that are here in the United States. And there's also a very large population of Israelis that are
Yeah, I don't think it's an existential threat. It's a threat. I don't want to, you know, sort of belittle the term existential because we're facing enough of those as it is. It's a threat, and it's a threat. It's not something new. We've always had a sort of ebb and flow of population in the state of Israel going back to 1948. How many of you have Israeli relatives living here? It's been going, and for many generations, it has been going on. What is new is the brain drain. And it's a way, is what they say in Hebrew, bayat ashirim. Why do we have a brain drain? Because we have so many smart people who are churning out of these universities who Israel has the highest percentage per capita in the world of physicians. It's impossible to get a job as a pediatrician in the state of Israel. We have the highest percentage of lawyers. We have the highest percentage of physicists. We have the highest percentage of musicians, all right, certainly. And it's difficult for them to find work. And it's difficult for the Israeli economy, even a very dynamic and expanding Israeli economy, to generate the type of work opportunities that would absorb all of these people. So there is a natural overspill. So now the state has actually recognized the problem, and they've created a special fund, and there's also a grassroots movement that goes along with it, and the Israeli diplomatic corps is very much involved in it, in actually reaching out to these people and giving them all sorts of incentives to come home and to try to create jobs for them. So the first step here, even on this problem, which is not an existential problem, the state of Israel is grappling with the problem. And I think they're taking it very seriously, and what I have seen so far is very impressive. So you may be saying goodbye to some of your Israeli neighbors soon. See you back in Israel. I'll take one more if there is one more. Sir. Yes. All of them? You can stop living outside of Israel. Why is Israel challenge the definition of refugee? And there are two different definitions of refugees in the world. There is the definition of a Palestinian refugee, and there's everybody else. There are two different organizations that handle Palestinian refugees and everybody else. Everybody else is handled by the High Commissioner of Refugees of the UN. And their purview, their task is to resettle refugees. The Palestinians are handled by UNRWA, Relief and Works, and their mandate is to perpetuate a refugee problem. Very different. So people who are now the grandsons, the great-grandchildren of Palestinian refugees from 1948 are kept in refugee camps and kept dependent on the UN apparatus because they're defined, they have a completely separate definition. And Israel is attempting all the time to assail this definition, all the time. At the same time, it's trying to get UN recognition for the status of the Jews who were kicked out of Arab lands as refugees. So it's a twofold operation. Have we succeeded? No. I think that the key to success lies in this country. You want to know something you can do? Here's something you can do, just on this. And this is not about existential threats, but about refugees. The majority, the bulk of the budget from UNRWA comes from your tax dollars. If you made it an issue in this country that why is the United States contributing to perpetuating a refugee problem, it could be made a political issue in this country. It'd be a worthwhile grassroots operation for you to undertake. What else can you do without short of actually picking up and moving there is awareness. It's all about awareness. Here, this book by Robert Baer. Why isn't this triggering a hue and cry? Why aren't there op-ed articles against this? Here is a book that is selling in Costco's that's telling the United States basically to sell its major allies down the drain and to give up and to surrender to the most vicious theocracy of recent times, of modern memory. Where is that? It's all about awareness. Awareness of the fact that Israel, which is often condemned in the UN for ecological crimes, we're also collective effects, that Israel is leading our region in attempts to save the environment, that is, it is providing water to the Jordanians, it's even providing water to the Saudis through the Jordanians. There is so much going on. So much going on. It's about awareness. I was telling, where's Rick? Rich. Rich, I was talking. Rick Richmond, where are you? Say hi. Hi, Richmond. I was telling you this story just before we came up here. about an email I got this week. You want to talk about something depressing? This is depressing. An email I got this week from the Macmillan Press. You all know Macmillan Press. It does the textbooks for your kids. You probably learned on Macmillan books. Macmillan published recently the Encyclopedia on Race and Racism. And guess what they had under the letter Z? Okay, this is after the UN had rescinded the vicious 1975 Zionism equals racism note. Macmillan Press says, no, Zionism still is racism. And they had turned to me and they asked me, would I write a rebuttal to their own, they now happen to have some complaints, they said, from Jewish organizations. Would I write a rebuttal to this entry in their encyclopedia? They promised to put it online and publish it in the next edition of the encyclopedia. I said, okay, I'll certainly read it. And then it was sent to me. The entry opens with the line, Zionism is racism because it is passed on through descent. Get this? Tell that to the 6,000 evangelical Zionists I had met in Texas a few weeks ago, that their mothers were Zionists. That's why they're Zionists. It goes on to list, and it's a long article, it's many thousands of words, lie after lie after lie. The one that got me, because right now I'm writing about Israel's creation. In 1947, all of the Arab states accepted the partition resolution and were willing to make peace with Israel, but Israel went to war to expand its territory and to kick out the Palestinians. This is Macmillan. I'm not kidding you, David. I wrote back to Macmillan and said I would not be party to disseminating hate literature to American students. And that I said, which I recommend, I said, frankly, you don't need an historian, you need a lawyer. But calling attention, why? This book has been on the shelves, I think, for a year already. Why hasn't this aroused a tremendous outcry in this country? Tremendous. This is anti-Semitism. It's not just anti-Zionism. And if you ask me what you can do, write a letter of protest to your local paper, talk to your congressman, write a letter of protest to Macmillan Press, make sure your school system doesn't have this dictionary, make sure it's not in your school libraries, it's not in your municipal libraries, it has no room, it is hate literature, it is. There are many, many things you can do, but we'd still like to have you in Israel.